From KLCC Radio, you're tuned in to a special presentation called Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. You've heard of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but the Tuesday following Thanksgiving has become known as Giving Tuesday. We'll be spending this hour speaking with some folks who are doing great things in our communities. We'll hear from those who are protecting our water, teaching children how to love reading, and from people like Michelle Rose of the Opal Center for Arts and Education in Cottage Grove about how they're embracing creative chaos as a way to make the arts truly inclusive.
The disabilities do not define the person, and so in creative chaos, you can come with whatever your ability is, and we will find you a place in a show.
Plus, we'll hear from Jamie McDonald, Chief Strategy Officer of the Giving Tuesday organization. All that and more coming up on Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. You've heard of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but today is Giving Tuesday. What is Giving Tuesday, you might ask? The organization, which is in its seventh year, describes their mission as a global generosity movement unleashing the power of people and organizations to transform their communities and the world. Today, we're pleased to welcome Jamie McDonald, Giving Tuesday's Chief Strategy Officer, who's joining us from Baltimore. Thanks for joining us, Jamie.
Thanks so much for having me, love.
Awesome. I'm so glad you're here. While you encourage giving throughout the year, today is your big day. It is Giving Tuesday.
It is. It's very exciting. It's really become a global movement. So while we celebrate it today, we think of it sort of like an anniversary in a marriage. You know, we work on it all year round. We've got activity all around the world in different ways throughout the year. But today is our anniversary, our big day of celebration.
Great. So I gave a very brief explanation of Giving Tuesday there, but it's a pretty unique initiative. Can you tell us more about it, please?
Sure. Giving Tuesday started 7 years ago with the idea that on the heels of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, when you bought gifts for friends and family, that Giving Tuesday would be a day to turn your attention to what gifts you can bring to the world in the form of your generosity, and whether that is time, talent, money, goods, or other ways that you can contribute to making your community a better place. And since that time, it has grown into a global movement with activity in every country on every continent. And so while you and your friends in Eugene are celebrating Giving Tuesday at a local level, there are people in communities just like Eugene around the world who are also doing generous and kind things to benefit their communities at a local level, every place you can think of.
So you mentioned you encourage community members to give back to their communities in so many various ways. You mentioned time, talents, goods, monetary donations. Can you tell us how these acts of generosity help strengthen communities and bring people together? I mean, that seems to be the big point there.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really inspiring to watch how, communities can really coalesce around the idea that generosity is in itself a form of power that gives you the power to sort of shape your community around a set of values that each individual person, brings to their community. So for somebody that, cares about social justice, they can use their generosity as a way to further social justice in their community. If somebody cares about animals, their generosity in any form can go to strengthening, the supports for animals in their community and so on. Because what we find is that there are so many things that sort of divide us these days. But generosity is one of those common values that across races, faith, political views, people can really join together and do something that gives them a sense of common purpose, of energy, and of, belief in shaping their community in a way that is, that is important to them and is going to make it a place that they feel proud about living in. And I would imagine Eugene is a place where, that's something that happens all the time, and Giving Tuesday is a great day to really sort of bring that to life.
You know, in this next hour, we'll be hearing from several local organizations who rely on volunteers and the generosity of others. So we're just really proud to be part of spreading the word on this Giving Tuesday. Jamie McDonald, Chief Strategy Officer for Giving Tuesday, thank you for joining us. Good luck today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, love. Good luck in Eugene today.
Thank you so much. You can find out more about Giving Tuesday as a global movement at givingtuesday.org. You can also listen to this program in its entirety, get links for all the organizations we're speaking with today, and more at our website, klcc.org. Oregon Community Programs has been serving youth and families for over 30 years in Lane County. Their mission is to support the use of evidence-based treatment for children and families with training, consulting, and outreach services to promote a positive family life. Today on this Giving Tuesday, we welcome Mindy Brock with Oregon Community Programs. Thanks for joining us, Mindy.
Thank you for having me.
So to start, can you give us a basic rundown what types of services Oregon Community Programs provides?
Of course. So we are an outpatient behavioral health and treatment foster care center here in Lane County.
So what types of programs do you provide that help support foster families and other families in the area?
For our outpatient services, that includes our trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, which is for child and adolescent treatment to address symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder for ages 3 and up, and the parent-child interaction therapy. That's short-term specialized behavioral management program designed for young children and their families ages 2 to 7, and then our treatment foster care.
Okay, so you work directly with both the families, so the adults and the children in those programs.
That's correct.
Okay, so what kind of results do families often get after they've received support from OCP?
Well, our approach is rooted in our evidence-based treatments and our services, and so, you know, we believe that by promoting a positive family life with the services that we do offer, I mean, the outcomes are great. It's lower rates of emotional and behavioral issues. The parents are learning more about parenting and how they can help their children.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you offer a variety of programs. Can you highlight one program for us and kind of dive into that and tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, so we're really excited to bring the KEEP program to Lane County through OCP. And, you know, we know there's about 1,400 foster children in Lane County. Being a foster parent is a super, super hard job. It's tough. Kiddos that come in, they are have behavioral or emotional issues, and parents sometimes don't know how to treat that. And so what KEEP does is it is it's a 16-weekly, 90-minute support group that focuses on the evidence-based parenting curriculum by promoting child well-being, reducing foster parent stress, and preventing placement breakdowns.
Okay, so you said you brought that to Lane County. Is this a program that's been available in other places?
Yes, it's currently implemented in the UK, Denmark, Tennessee, New York, and in Portland.
Okay. And so when foster families come to you through the KEEP program, can you tell us about some of the actual activities or hands-on things that they're actually getting and benefiting from being a participant in the KEEP program?
Right, right. So, you know, it's a trauma-informed model. And so and what that means is that it's shown to increase placement stability and foster parent retention. And it also increases the number of positive permanency outcomes and options such as reunification or adoption.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when you say it's, trauma-informed, are you saying that a lot of times when children come into foster care, they've experienced various types of trauma, and so you're helping these families to best guide the children through that? Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yes. So the tailored sessions. So the curriculum and the priority is based on the participants of each KEEP group,
okay,
which is any DHS foster parent with a current youth placed in their home from the ages 4 to 12, or a relative placement, kinship family. What they learn is that to encourage perspective shifts, they allow skills sharing, open discussion, and it's all about reinforcing pro-social behavior and the desired behaviors of non-harsh, effective limit setting.
Okay, so when a family comes into this KEEP group, and I understand you just started a new one yesterday,
yep.
Do you kind of take the pulse of that group and see what are the issues that those specific families are having, and then let that guide the support that you provide for them? Can you talk about that?
Yes, that's correct. So each family comes into the group and we ask them to select a focus child. And what that is it could be any of the children that they have in their home, a foster child from age 4 to 12. And what we do is every week a KEEP program manager will call them and they go through a list of behaviors. Did it happen? And then they go through, and every week they ask the same questions over and over. And what KEEP has done with the evidence base that they do is it shows that those emotions or behaviors are now in control and that they've gone down.
Okay, so they're checking in the frequency of the behavior that they've identified as problematic, and then they're checking in on them and offering them advice and support in order to keep bringing those behaviors under control.
That's correct.
Okay, awesome.
That's correct.
You mentioned kinship parents, and I think I have a clear understanding of what that is, but can you clarify that for us?
Of course. So, you know, it's a relative, so it could be a grandparent that is now in custody of their grandchild, or it could be an aunt taking care of her nephew.
I'm sure that presents some unique challenges.
It does. And I think people don't, you know, families want to make sure that the children stay within the family if they can. And if they have that support and the network where they can do that, I think they will. So I think that this is a great thing for KEEP because normally kinship families don't have any support out there.
Right. It is Giving Tuesday, and we're highlighting how community members can be generous to local organizations and the various needs that organizations have. What is your biggest need right now, Mindy?
Our biggest need is money to help the kiddos. They come into the programs, into foster care. Sometimes they have nothing. Sometimes they just have the clothes that they're wearing. So, I mean, it could be a car seat. Maybe they need a hygiene kit, mm-hmm. Or clothing, or they need money to get their driver's license.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of these times we don't expect the foster parents to pay for these. And so as a nonprofit, we find it difficult sometimes to be able to offer these services to the families that need them the most.
So donations that people might choose to give to OCP are going directly to help the children that are in foster care, the families that have sought out your support?
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. What about families who are considering becoming foster families? Is that something that Oregon Community Programs facilitates?
Yes, and we always need foster parents. There's a huge, huge need for them in Lane County. You know, we are treatment foster care, so we give them 24-hour support. There's a ton of benefits that are involved with that, and they have weekly meetings. Our program supervisors work as a heavy, so if the family is having issues with the kiddo, the program supervisor is the one that's going to talk with the kid, so there's not that animosity between the foster family and the kiddo. But all 24-hour support, it's something we always need. And it's a hard, hard job. It really is. But we only place one child per home.
Okay.
So we can really emphasize and work on the behavioral and emotional issues.
Right. And I'm sure there's information about that on the Oregon Community Programs website.
Yes. And okay. That would be OregonCommunityPrograms.org.
Okay.
And I just have to say that we have foster parents that have been doing this with OCP, some of them for 9 years, up to 16 years.
Okay, amazing.
Yeah, they love the program.
Wow. And they seek out your support because every child's situation is different.
That's correct.
How do families find your services?
They're usually, for the outpatient, it could be that they're recommended by a therapist or a school counselor or even a doctor. And with our treatment foster care, we've been trying to get out into the community, reaching more people to learn about OCP. But it's usually referrals from our current foster parents.
Okay. Foster parents that are saying, hey, I've got this great resource for you. They're kind of have a network of people that they rely on already outside of OCP maybe, and then bringing them into your group to offer the professional help.
That's correct.
Awesome.
Yes.
Well, thanks for all the work you do. It sounds like it's a very inspiring program, the KEEP program, which is new to Oregon Community Programs. Where can people go to find more information?
For the KEEP program, they can visit keepfostering.org and they can refer themselves. They do. Their caseworker doesn't need to know that they're coming. If they want to join, they can join. Their only stipulation is that their current foster parent or kinship parent, and that they have a placed youth from the age of 4 to 12 in their family. It's free. We pay a $20 incentive, a weekly incentive for them to come. We supply some food and snacks, free child care. So that if they come and they have a kiddo, well, bring them with.
Okay. Great. Thank you for joining us, Mindy.
Thank you.
To find out more about Oregon Community Programs, visit OregonCommunityPrograms.org. You can also find out more about all the organizations we're speaking with today at our website, klcc.org. Just ahead, we'll have a discussion about how Mary's River Watershed Council works with landowners to protect water quality in Corvallis. And I'll be speaking with Michelle Rose of the Opal Center, a creative outlet and venue offering artistic opportunity and inclusion in Cottage Grove. I'm Love Cross. You're listening to Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. You're listening to Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. You might have heard of a local watershed council, but maybe you don't know much about what they do. There are 88 community-based, voluntary, non-regulatory watershed councils across the state of Oregon. All of them are meant to assess conditions in a watershed, usually a river or creek and the lands that drain into them, and then conduct projects to restore or enhance the waters and lands for fish and native plants in their areas. Oregon is one of the few states to have this community-based model. I'm pleased to be joined today by Holly Purpura, Executive Director of the Mary's River Watershed Council in Corvallis, and Diane Blakeney, a landowner who's benefited from the Mary's River Watershed Council. Thank you both for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We're happy to be here.
So we've established the goal of a watershed council, but Holly, can you tell us more about the Mary's River organization?
Yeah, to tell you first about the Mary's River itself. The Mary's River flows through four counties, Benton, Polk, Lincoln, and Lane counties, Oregon. And it provides drinking water for both Corvallis as well as Philomath, Oregon. And the Mary's River Watershed Council works to help be stewards of this natural resource and this asset to the communities. And so part of the work we do is focused around restoration. And so that is focused on helping to enhance habitat for species that call the Mary's River home, like salmon, trout, Pacific lamprey, beaver, and other critters. And we also work with environmental education too, particularly in Benton County.
One of the things you do is work directly with landowners whose property includes tributaries to the Mary's River. So I'm curious to know about the process there. Do you usually reach out to landowners or do they seek you out?
We usually reach out to landowners. All of our restoration work is on a voluntary basis. So we work collaboratively with landowners, strategically go about determining sites for doing this habitat enhancement by carrying out rapid bioassessments. And then we contact the landowners through that process. And then I work with a fish biologist to help design restoration projects that we then present to the landowner to see if it's something they would be interested in putting on their property.
So you work with landowners like the Blakeneys to restore their property to a more natural state. Diana, tell us what the restoration project on your land involved.
Well, it's an interesting process because this land has been in our family since 1921. And Rock Creek runs, which is a tributary to Mary's River, runs across our property, as does a smaller tributary to Rock Creek known as Griffith Creek. The Mary's River Watershed Council had been in contact with my mother, who was the owner of the property before me and my two siblings inherited it upon her death. And so the Watershed Council was very good with my mother in terms of talking about the potential of putting some large log placements in our portions of Rock Creek and Griffith Creek. Griffith Creek, we have about a quarter of a mile on our property, and about a little over a mile of Rock Creek. So upon my mother's death, I took up the reins of dealing with Mary's River Watershed Council, and my siblings and I became quite enamored with the idea of improving the watershed for Mary's that ran through our property, because it would not only create habitat for the cutthroat trout, but would also cool the water and make the Mary's a better stream as a result. And so what happened was there were 16 placements, large wood placements on our property, 7 on Griffith Creek and 9 on Rock Creek. And over time, instead of having the rapid flow during the winter of scouring down to the bedrock, these large log placements have over since 2014, which is when they were put in, has added some gravel, has added some capturing some of the wood that comes flowing down the river naturally, and creating some nice calm areas for the breeding of the cutthroat trout. In addition, we got the benefit of having riparian plantings put in, and also a culvert that was running near a forest road that was near Rock Creek.
And this project's only 5 years old, it sounds like, so it's continuing to evolve. Those plantings you mentioned are probably really starting to flourish.
They are, and the watershed is still coming and checking to see how they're doing and weed whacking around them, so the competition is from time to time reduced.
Right. Holly, is this kind of the typical project that you might take on with Mary's Watershed Council?
It is. It's similar to many of the projects that we've put in, and a lot of our restoration projects are very location dependent, and so it depends on the flow of the stream through there, as well as the species that inhabit that stretch of the Mary's River. And so some restoration projects we may focus more so on encouraging beaver presence, or we may focus on cutthroat trout like we have on the Blakeney's property. And as well, I do work from the headwaters of the Mary's, and we're beginning to expand to do more work in the urban centers too. We recently did a filtering wetland, for instance, working with the City of Corvallis and the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition at the Starker Arts Park in Corvallis.
How does the public benefit from the work that you do?
Yeah, I just actually read a statistic here earlier today about how the decline in some wanted populations have impacted 135 different species, including humans, and that salmon are around 5% of their historic numbers. And so we're working to try to restore habitat for both spawning and salmon and cutthroat trout reproduction, as well as working with other species too. And the analogy that I've heard before is it's like a canary in a coal mine, seeing the decline in salmon population in the Pacific Northwest, particularly a species that we rely so heavily on. It's indicative of something being wrong in our systems, in our watersheds. And so the Mary's River and watershed councils across the state are working to try to address that and try to restore habitat back to what it more naturally looked like.
Diana, what are you most proud of for being associated with this project for Mary's River Watershed Council?
What I'm most proud of is seeing the difference in Rock Creek. From the time I was a kid, we spent many a summer fishing on the creek and hanging out with my mom and my uncle. And to see the complexity of the creek and to understand why the complexity matters is just huge, because there's a huge difference between how it looked when I was a kid in, you know, the early 50s to what it looks like now, and knowing that what we're doing now is better than what it looked like in the 50s.
And for generations to come.
And for generations to come.
Right. On this Giving Tuesday, thank you to Holly Purpura, Executive Director of the Mary's River Watershed Council in Corvallis, and landowner Diana Blakeney. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To learn more about Mary's River Watershed Council, go to mrwc.org. You can also find contact information for all the organizations we're speaking with today at our website, klcc.org. Today, on this Giving Tuesday, we're celebrating organizations that uphold values that bring us together and help create joy. Cottage Grove, population 10,000, has a gem right in the heart of downtown. The Opal Center for Arts and Education offers opportunities for educational and culturally enriching, unique and diverse programming. This includes theater shows, parades, community classes, and more. Joining me is the Executive Director of the Opal Center, Michelle Rose. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't you start by telling us a little about the Opal Center? How did it get started?
The Opal Center was started by Ivan Del Sol, it became a nonprofit in 2011. It was a few other entities prior, also as an art and education centers, but it was the Arcade Theater and it was the Art of Everything. Over the years, Ivan realized that to keep his vision alive, he needed to reach out to the community. And that's when he and the board of directors decided to become a nonprofit.
Okay, so what I understand from the Opal Center is that the mission is to create a diverse community through artistic expression. So I'm curious to know how the programs you offer help you try to meet that goal.
We actually offer quite a diverse programming. We have what we call a black box theater, which then we produce plays that are original and by local artists. We also do a few plays that are what would be considered nationally known plays. And we have a children's theater, which does a summer camp and regular all-year-long classes. We also have one of my favorite aspects of the theater is Creative Chaos, which is an all-abilities theater company, which is open to anybody who really wants to act, but it does cater to people that maybe haven't found a home where acting is their thing.
Right. When I visited the Opal Center's website, the first thing I saw were beautiful images of people dressed in costume from what looks to be a 2019 trash and show. I'll ask you more about that in a minute. But you also highlight the phrase Creative Chaos All Abilities Theater. So that's what you're talking about here. What does that mean?
The disabilities do not define the person. And so in Creative Chaos, you can come with whatever your ability is, and we will find you a place in a show. Creative Chaos presently is producing two shows a year, and each role is tailored to that person. We also are starting, beginning in November, every month Creative Chaos will produce a different event specifically for people with different abilities who maybe don't fit into the mainstream, like going to a bar or going to a movie theater. So we are trying to create an environment that's very friendly and accommodating.
So I would gather that that draws people from outside of Cottage Grove to participate in that program, as well as local community members.
Yes, we mostly focus on Cottage Grove and then more south, as Eugene does have quite a few awesome programs. So we reach out to communities like Elkton and Drain and Yoncalla and Curtin, which also don't have programs for people with other abilities.
Right. What do you think that means for those people that get involved in that, to have that creative outlet and to feel that support from the community?
I think they really appreciate it. They do, their families do, their personal support workers do. It's, you know, something we take for granted that there's so much to do. But when you don't quite fit the mold, it's harder to find events to do.
Right. That's lovely. You provide that. So can we talk about those costumes I mentioned that's front and center on your website? Beautiful photography, interesting costumes, Michelle. What is the annual Trash and Show?
Well, the Trash and Show is our annual fashion show where everything is made from trash. We're not talking upcycle. We're not talking even recycle. We are talking trash. And we are a group of between 10 and 15, depending on whether people are busy or not, designers that design trash-in. And I think we are one of the only trash-in shows in the area from what I have seen. Some of our designers have taken their designs to Portland, and we actually did a little show here in Eugene for Visual Arts Week. I've made dresses out of bubble wrap, plastic containers, caution tape. Let's see, one of my favorites was actually, we have Pacific Yurts in Cottage Grove, and the insulation that they use, all the scraps were thrown into a dumpster, which are not recycled. So we've had a lot of fun over the years. Each year it gets better. So we hope that you join us in the future. We usually do 3 days. We like to focus on Earth Day. And part of our mission is to educate people on trash and the fact that it isn't so usable.
Right, right.
So we invite you to come visit us next year.
It sounds a little unorthodox, but something that would be different every year you do it, because the materials are changing and you can, the sky's the limit when it comes to that. That sounds like a lot of fun. So having that center right in the heart of downtown Cottage Grove seems pretty important, and you're pretty fortunate to have that space. What do you think the center means to the entire community of Cottage Grove, not just those who are volunteering and who are performing, but just to have that in Cottage Grove?
I think people really appreciate that our space is a place where anybody can come. We love Cottage Theater, but it's definitely a more formal atmosphere. We tend to have smaller productions, which makes it easier. And we also invite volunteers to come in at any time and help us. Because we have such a variety of activities, it means that there's something for everybody.
Right.
And so that makes it inviting.
I understand you also have a children's theater camp as one of your programs, which sounds pretty amazing. Can you tell us more about that program? How do people get involved with that?
Well, the program is new. We've just started it in 2019, but our theater camp is 1 week for littles, as we call them, and a two-week program for older kids. The littles focus on basic, the little skits and learning about how the theater parts all happen together. And then the older kids actually work on writing scripts, working on music, costuming, props, backstage management, promotion, and, you know, so they cover all of the theater. And so we kind of work with the littles to get them ready for that, and then the older kids we focus on different aspects, because there really is a place for anybody. Not everybody wants to be on the stage, so our camp is a little more diverse than some theater.
Right.
Camps.
They're learning some valuable real world skills,
yes,
I would imagine. And so it sounds like you're just dipping your toe into that theater camp, but you're hoping to grow that in the future.
We are. And if people are interested in helping out or want more information, they can always contact us, and you know, we love volunteers.
Very good. So it is Giving Tuesday, which is all about encouraging community members to support local nonprofits like yours, whether it's through volunteering their time, as you've said, or maybe their talents, or making monetary contributions. So how does the Opal Center benefit from donations from community members, whether it's their time or their money?
Well, being a nonprofit, as everybody knows, you're always scrambling for money. We use our donations for costumes and props, and occasionally also paying leaders for, say, our camps and other events. We always need volunteers to work the door, to help backstage, to do postering, you know, run the gambit. But we are always willing to talk to people to help them find a place in the theater. So we can use you in some way.
There's lots to do with a theater production, so I'm sure every detail has to be covered, so those volunteers are important.
Oh, very much
absolutely.
So we have two employees, so
okay.
Yeah, everything else is volunteer.
And lots of volunteers.
Yes.
So a final question I'd like to ask you is, what are you most proud of being involved with the Opal Center?
I think just the fact that we do such a variety of programs and that we reach out to the community to be part of that, and that we have been able to sustain ourselves, somewhat sustain ourselves over the years. So, that. But yeah, it's just a wonderful group of people to work with, and I look forward to seeing what we do in the future.
Well, we do too. Michelle Rose of the Opal Center in Cottage Grove, thank you so much for joining us on this Giving Tuesday, and we'll be keeping an eye on you. Good luck in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To find out more about the Opal Center for Arts and Education, visit opalcentercg.org. You can also find out more about all the organizations we're speaking with today at our website, klcc.org. Coming up, we'll discuss the importance reading comprehension has on a child's education and the ways Smart Reading is trying to develop a lifelong love of reading in children here in Oregon. Plus, KLCC benefits from a nonprofit organization itself. I'll be speaking with Morgan Monroe, president of the KLCC Public Radio Foundation. I'm Love Cross. I'll have all of that and more on this special presentation, Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. You're listening to Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. Smart Reading began in 1992 as a way to reinforce the idea that reading matters. Today, we're joined by the program's area manager for Benton, Lane, and Linn counties, Kari Rosenfeld, Amber Jackson, a volunteer reader, and Charlie Jett, principal of Two Rivers Dos Rios Elementary School in Springfield. Nice to have you all here.
It's great to be here.
So I just gave a very brief background of Smart Reading. Kari, can you tell us more about who you are and what you do?
I sure can. Again, you mentioned I'm the area manager for Lane, Linn, and Benton County. Smart Reading is a statewide children's literacy nonprofit organization that serves kids in Oregon in their highest need schools with two critical elements for literacy and learning success. And one of those is one-on-one reading, and the second is access to books. We're focused on helping kids learn to enjoy reading, and when kids think reading is fun, they do it. And when they want to read, they are more likely to master that skill. Our volunteers read one-on-one with students weekly during the school year and provide a fun and child-guided experience, which is also culturally affirming, and they work with the kids to help them just have fun and enjoy the experience.
So volunteers go directly into the school. So Charlie, you use this program at Two Rivers Dos Rios. What kind of impact has it had on students? And I assume there's been impact on teachers as well.
Yeah, this is a terrific, terrific program. When having a child being able to have someone read a book to them is just makes a profound difference in general. And the students get very excited. They want to meet with the adults coming in and sit with them. And when the adult comes in and the students are sitting together, students are able to hear a good prosody in reading. So the mentors are reading with good inflection and making great, you know, dialogue happen, and the books come to life. And also just students getting basic concepts of print, knowing that words and sentences are read from left to right. The students just light up. We have students at our school who don't want to go to recess. They want to actually just go to Smart Reading, and they're willing to give up lunchtime and other instructional pieces just to have that engagement. I think that the relationships are key, just any opportunity for an adult to sit and read with a child and also then a child to read with the adult is very powerful.
So what age group of children are we talking about here?
At Two Rivers Dos Rios, Smart Reading serves our first graders, just our first grade students. And I think that's really important when you consider that we are trying to get all students to be reading at benchmark by third grade, that nationally, that there's many studies that show if students are not reading at benchmark by third grade, they're four times as likely to drop out of high school. So targeting early our first graders to getting them reading at and getting those phonological skills and phonics and decoding words early is important. Just as you would in medicine, it's that early diagnosis of knowing that there might be some troubles with reading so that we're not having to do anything in the back end at third grade really intensely. So we are really targeting the first graders. Every single first grader gets to go to Smart Reading once a week for half an hour. And that's a short period of time, but kids get excited about it. And again, as Carrie was saying, that is important that kids get excited about reading to be engaged.
Right. And first graders love recess. So to know that they're choosing to stay in and read with a volunteer is quite impressive,
yes.
I would say. Yeah. So I'm a parent of teenagers, and we spent countless hours reading books together when they were younger. How do you think sharing in a book with a child differs from having a child read by themselves?
It's the engagement. Again, hearing somebody older who hopefully is a proficient reader bring the text to life with good inflection and expression really shows the power of the literature to a child, because a child may not be able to fully decode and make those connections. There might be some context clues that don't connect at those times, and the comprehension may not be there, or vocabulary. And an adult who's able to stop and make sense of the text, give context, clarify vocabulary, makes a really big impact.
Right. So much more than that tablet mm-hmm. engagement you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, Amber, you volunteer with Smart Reading, and it is Giving Tuesday. And on Giving Tuesday, people are encouraged to find opportunities to volunteer, maybe to give monetary donations. But what I'm curious to know is what a typical day in the life of a Smart volunteer would be.
Okay. Well, this year I'm working with three little readers. One is in kindergarten and the other two are in first grade. The kindergartner loves to use my pencil as a wand to point to the words in the book and keeps busy counting the number of things on the page. And my first graders are working so hard at sounding out words with more than one syllable in them and then reading mini books. So by the end of the year, we'll probably start seeing the transition of those kids reading chapter books. And that's a huge milestone.
So how can people get involved with Smart Reading?
We would love for you to volunteer. That number one, we are searching for 100 more eager people who would like to read with kids. And you do not need any specialized skills to sit and read with a child an hour or more a week. We also, we're looking for 100 people, and we're asking our community to do that. And of course, monetary gifts, financial support for SMART is primary so that we can reach our goals and reach more children. And there's a lot of children out there who would benefit from some reading support. And our community can actually be the solution to that.
Is there a website that they can go to learn more?
Absolutely. Okay. www.smartreading.org.
Okay, Amber, so as a volunteer and a council member, what are you most proud of being associated with Smart Reading?
I'm proud of the book giveaway days, just seeing the joy on the kids' faces when they get to choose and select their own book to take home for their personal library is just amazing. We've given over 23,000 books in our area, and so we're really proud of that. I would also say the volunteer experience, just being with like-minded people who care about children's literacy and that just have a huge passion for sharing the joys of reading.
And Charlie, it wouldn't be fair if I didn't ask you the same question. What makes you most proud to be affiliated with Smart Reading and have that in your school?
Well, I'm very proud that SMART's in the classrooms and working with our teachers and our students. It's just the faces on our students every day. I mean, it's what you can't capture in the data. And there's some great student outcomes that have been happening throughout the community and with SMART's impact. But I like students being excited about reading, going and saying, I get to go to SMART today. I get to go to read with somebody, and I get to take a book home, because I don't have a book at home. I mean, it's heartbreaking when you hear a child say, I don't have a lot of books at home. You know, we are a Title I school, Two Rivers Dos Rios in Springfield, and we have a lot of impacted families, and this program is helping bring print into houses and into the homes so that students can have a book and they can read it before bedtime and read with their families. And that, for me, really just warms my heart and our staff's heart.
Amazing. Well, I'd like to thank Kari Rosenfeld, Charlie Jett, and Amber Jackson for joining us on this Giving Tuesday. Good luck in all of your efforts and keep up the good work. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To find out more about smart reading, visit smartreading.org. KLCC has existed for more than 50 years and is supported by Lane Community College, who holds the license with the FCC. KLCC reaches 80,000 listeners a week with about 6,500 members throughout Western and Central Oregon and beyond who donate to the station. About 5 years ago, a group of community leaders came together and created a nonprofit to support KLCC. The KLCC Public Radio Foundation was born. Their first and current president, Morgan Monroe, is here to tell us a little more about their story. Welcome, Morgan.
Thank you, love.
I think the first place to start is to tell us what is the purpose of the KLCC Public Radio Foundation.
The KLCC Public Radio Foundation exists to help KLCC thrive and help KLCC connect to and serve this community that we all live in and that we love.
So what are some of the specific ways that the foundation helps support our station?
We really take our lead from what the station asks for. That's one of the things that the foundation has really made a point to do, is we get to ask the station, what would help you the most? And then we work with donors in our community to help make those dreams come true. For example, we support the Journalism Fellow, who was recently Mallory Begay, but her term ended, and so now we get to have Elizabeth Gabriel here at the station. We also support infrastructure at the station, and we also can have made some other gifts directly to the station for special projects.
Well, I can tell you, being a member of the KLCC news team, that having the addition of our journalism fellow with Mallory was our inaugural one from the foundation was just fabulous over the last year. We are a small news team, but we cover a wide area. Mallory did great work for us. We were really sad to see her go, but we're so pleased to have Elizabeth. So the foundation is definitely making a direct impact on how we're able to serve our listeners. So thank you for that. So how is giving to the KLCC Public Radio Foundation different from giving to KLCC as one might as a listener member?
Sure. All of the members of the foundation are also members of KLCC, so there's a lot in common between the two ways to give. But the foundation is a 501c3, so that lets us accept donor-advised funds. If someone's setting up an estate planning gift, that's also a great opportunity for them to work with us. It can simplify things for folks who are giving to the station in a lot of ways, particularly people who have sort of a complicated gift.
Right, and you can also invest that money to help make money on that, which is not what we do with our listener member funds.
Right.
Okay. I know that you're a young mom, a professional organization coach. Why do you spend your free time supporting and leading this organization?
I grew up in this community, and my folks taught me and my sister that what we do as members of a community is you participate. You step up and you do the work because otherwise, we're just people who live in the same zip code or the same town. It's not a community. It's not a neighborhood. And for it to become a place where we want to live and we want to be, I think that's one of the most exciting things about all the organizations you're profiling today with this program, is that they're all examples of people in our community saying, this is something I can do to make the world a better place, to make our community a healthier place, to make our kids stronger, to make any of that. And so this is one of the ways that I do this. And there's so many other folks out there who've also stepped up in ways that are right for them and participated.
Morgan, it's always a pleasure to have you in studio. We really thank you for all the work you do for our station. And on this Giving Tuesday, I'd like to offer a generous thank you to you and to the entire KLCC Public Radio Foundation. Thank you for all you do.
Oh, thank you, love. And thank you, everybody at the station. We're essentially your fan club. So it's really our pleasure to get to step up and help in these ways, because you and your colleagues do such amazing work in our community. And our community is better for the work that you do. So thank you.
To find out more about the KLCC Public Radio Foundation, visit klcc.org.
While you're there, you can also listen to this program in its entirety and get contact information for all the organizations we've spoken with today. As we conclude this program, I'd like to note there are so many wonderful nonprofit organizations, and we couldn't possibly speak to all of them in the time we had for this broadcast. However, the spirit of Giving Tuesday is one that we hope to embrace the entire year, and know that we consider your comments, your PSA requests, and your suggestions very carefully. We're always trying to highlight the generous and inspiring work that's being done in our communities. You can always reach out to us, send us an email, klcc@klcc.org. Since announcing this program, we've heard from many organizations who are doing meaningful work. And as I said earlier, we couldn't speak to everyone for this program, but we did want to take some time to mention a few more. They are the Diabetes Community Care Team in Eugene, working to help people with all types of diabetes manage the challenges of living with a chronic disease and mitigate barriers to care, including financial, psychological, and medical. They are online at dcct.life. The Olalla Center in Toledo has provided mental health services for children in Lincoln County since 1978. More information at olallacenter.org. In Eugene, the Environmental Law Alliance Worldwide, or ELAW, helps communities speak out for clean air, clean water, and a healthy planet. You can reach them at elaw.org. And Burrito Brigade, they're a nonprofit organization whose mission is to feed the hungry and unhoused in Oregon by hand-delivering vegan meals for free. You can go volunteer, chop up some vegetables, and wrap some burritos. More information online at burritobrigade.org. And finally, thank you for listening. Thank you to the organizations who are part of our program. And thank you for all your support, whether it's toward KLCC or however you choose to invest in our communities. Your generosity of your time, your money, or simply your kindness makes this place truly special. It's one of the reasons why this is such a great place to call home. Today's broadcast was produced by Jason Brown with help from Ronell Curry. I'm Love Cross, and you're listening to KLCC.